Welcome to UCCF's Christian Persuaders podcast, a series of interviews with people from around the world gifted and passionate about communicating and defending the Christian gospel. For more information about UCCF, Christian Persuaders, and more episodes from this podcast, do go to uccf.org.uk/Christian-Persuaders. Well, today we're in conversation with Oz Guinness, who's a writer and who lives in Washington. Tell us a bit about yourself, Oz.
I'm a writer, descended from a long line of Irish brewers.
Okay.
And I always feel my calling is partly to be a Christian apologist and make sense of the gospel to those outside in the world, and then partly an analyst and make sense of the world to people in the church.
Ah.
So I have fun doing both of those.
Fantastic. We're going to focus on one event you've spoken at recently in California, is that right? Paint us a picture. Where were you and what was the context?
This year I've done six of the Veritas forums in different parts of the United States, and probably the best was in UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, where they had something like 1,500 at the lecture.
Gosh.
And every one of the groups on campus joined together with a tremendous amount of prayer and preparation, and it was a great group with an incredible evening of questions afterward.
Fantastic. So what was the question you started with?
Well, my talk was simply called The Journey, A Thinking Person's Quest for Meaning.
Okay.
And I have a number of talks, but that one's probably the most popular. I take Socrates' statement, the unexamined life is not worth living, and outline what it takes to be a seeker and the four phases that seekers go through. First, introducing the whole idea of seeking, because in much of the educated world, people don't even want to think at all. But the first phase is a time for questions, and that's what constitutes a seeker. And Freud was dead wrong when he talked about belief being a crutch, because the fact is no one believes because they have needs. What their needs do is help them disbelieve what they used to believe that no longer satisfies. So life becomes a question, and they set out and search for answers. That's the first phase. Second phase is a time for answers. Obviously, pretty logically following on. But that's a more conceptual and comparative stage when people who have a need start searching, and there are obviously many answers on offer. And I take what I call the big three families of faiths, the Eastern, Hinduism, Buddhism, the New Age, the secularist, atheists, agnostics, naturalists, materialists, and the biblical, particularly Jews and Christians, and show how the big three families of faiths give very radically different answers to the human origins, to human dignity, to evil, to, right down to the prospects for the human race. And then the third phase of the quest is a time for evidences, what the lawyers call due diligence, or what the philosophers call justification. In other words, what are the reasons for the faith that people are attracted to? And the fourth stage, a time for commitments, when all the implications of the search come together, and people at this stage, hopefully, commit themselves, mind, heart, body, soul, reason, feelings, to Christ. And so I describe the various stages and then challenge them to think through where each of them is on the path.
Now, that's a phenomenally succinct summary of an hour-long lecture. Is that available online? Can people hear the full?
I think you can on the Veritas website. I've also written it into a book. It's called Long Journey Home, published by Waterbrook Doubleday. And you can certainly find that on Google.
Now,
I mean, on Amazon, so you can go over there too.
So, but tell us perhaps of your journey into producing that book and that talk. I mean, how did you come up with this approach and this argument? Can you share
that? I came to faith in the early 1960s,
okay.
A time you had to think through everything back to square one. Swinging London, exploding counterculture, and so on. So it's a time you had to engage the culture and really relate your faith to what was going on. The apologetic part of that, I was most helped by Francis Schaeffer at the Labrie community in Switzerland. And he is by far the best apologist in practice I have ever met. Now, his books don't give you half of the brilliance of the way he did it. Because he didn't write his books. They're from lectures, transposed, transcribed, and so on. But the way he would do it with people, and I would say, summarizing Schaeffer, he took God passionately seriously. He took people passionately seriously. And he took truth passionately seriously. And he was a brilliant apologist. And it all went back to his understanding of Romans 1. Unbelievers hold the truth in unrighteousness, as Paul says. So no one is totally wrong. Everyone has the truth down there. So you can always work from the half truth or the half lie. And I later discovered through Peter Berger, that's the way he approaches, say, postmodern people. And Berger always says two very little simple ways of doing it. One, when you're talking of people, say, skepticism, his answer is always, relativize the relativizer. Or Schaeffer would say, push them out to the logic of their assumptions. Jesus would say, by their fruit you know them. Not the seed, the fruit. C.S. Lewis would say, push them out to the absolute ruddy end. And whenever people are skeptical or relativist or whatever, that's the negative way of approaching them. Push them out. The positive way for Peter Berger, point them to the signals of transcendence in their own experience. And you have C.S. Lewis, surprised by joy. He couldn't explain joy as an atheist. Or you have G.K. Chesterton's famous, he was stopped in his tracks, and he was on the verge of becoming a black pessimist, stops in his tracks by a dandelion. The sheer beauty and the wonder of existence, even in something very simple like a dandelion, was a signal of transcendence. It pointed beyond his black pessimism to a different solution, and he became a seeker. And I use those positive approaches or the negative approaches when I speak to people.
So, lessons from Francis Schaeffer, being passionate about God and people and truth, and the apologetic method of pushing the unbelieving position to the ruddy end, but also pointing to these signs of transcendence. How would you model this in the Journey Home lecture and book?
Well, in the first phase, A Time for Questions, I just raised the question, if meaning and belonging is so important, making sense of our world and finding security in life, is that why don't more people think about it more of the time? And the fact is, most people, most of the time, don't. Well, there's two great answers in philosophical history. One is Pascal's answer. People surround themselves by diversion. Divertissement, he says. In other words, a busy, entertaining distraction so they don't think. And obviously, our age with iPods and all these various things, we have endless new technological reinforcements for just living in our own heads, getting on with our own worlds with videos and all these things. They're not wrong, but a lot of people simply don't think. The other way people refuse to think is what the philosophers and poets have called bargaining. And the great example in Western literature is Faust. In other words, people say, I don't want to think about it now. And we deny death. And, you know, when people are in their 20s, they're immortal. And slowly around the so many bends of the river, you realize you can hear the sound of the rapids. Death is coming. And it gets closer. But people say, later, later, when I've married, you know, when my mortgage is paid off, when my kids have graduated, when I'm retired, then I'll have time to think about it. But later. But, of course, the Faust figure is the person who puts it forth, puts it off right till death, and then he's willing to sell his soul to the devil to have a little more time, to gain a little more knowledge and a little more power. And of course, the devil has read the fine print, and Faust hasn't, and so eventually he has to pay. But you can see, either through diversion or through bargaining, a lot of people simply don't think. And so Socrates' phrase, the unexamined life is not worth living, there are a good many students, there are a good many professors, many in the educated classes, who love Socrates, but they've never examined life. So I use, as it were, any and all means to raise questions, to get them to think, because that's what makes them a seeker. People who are happy-go-lucky, self-sufficient, they're not thinking at all.
And you're encouraging a seeker's attitude, encouraging questions by putting the spotlight on why we don't ask questions and unmasking, showing the folly perhaps of either burying ourselves in diversions or by delaying. So now people are asking, what do you do next?
Well, in Time for Answers, I really explore some of the big issues. I usually either take a big negative one, like evil, or take a big positive one, like human dignity. I mean, you take human dignity. If you look at the Eastern religions, and when I was much younger, I studied under a guru in Rishikesh, and really explored it as well as I could, and I lived 10 years out in a Buddhist culture. So I know Hinduism and Buddhism pretty well. You cannot ground a high view of humanity in either of those. Because when we take ourselves seriously, we're in this world of maya or illusion, and we're perpetuating the desire, the craving, the attachment which binds us to the wheel. And the goal in both Buddhism and Hinduism, with their differences, is that freedom is freedom from individuality, not freedom to be an individual. Mm. Or you can take, say, Western secularism. Many of the high humanists, like Julian Huxley, for example, are really parasitic on the Christian faith. And they cannot find, in their purely naturalistic explanation of the universe, a high view of humanity. And you have philosophers like John Gray who say they are cheating. And Gray would call himself an anti-humanist secularist. And so you have, or you have someone like Peter Singer, you know, the animal rights philosopher at Princeton, the Australian. If humans are whom he says they are, why do they have human rights? It's precisely in the difference that the gospel and the scriptures make, because humans are made in the image of God and they have an inalienable dignity. So I would look at things like human dignity or the problem of evil and show that differences make a difference.
Hmm.
People have got to choose. They're not all the same. And when you see the difference, one of my simple apologetic assumptions is that contrast is the mother of clarity.
Okay.
Contrast is the mother of clarity. Look at how differences make a difference, and then you've got a choice between very clear choices.
Now, I'm tempted to move from the content of your apologetic to the style of its communication, raising the issue of clarity being, what was the mother of? Contrast is the mother of clarity, is probably the sister of understanding. But contrast, now, you're a very clear, thought-through, well-illustrated communicator. That may just be the Irish gift of the gab. And apart from injecting Irish DNA onto our bloodstreams, how have you developed as a speaker in terms of practice or experience, or what would you share with younger aspiring communicators?
Well, with learning anything, I would say always go for a mentor.
Okay.
In other words, you'll never get it first and foremost from books. And I would say that about scholarship generally. I mean, go to a great scholar if you want to do graduate work, say, and study under him or her. And that's certainly true of apologetics, because it's not taught best, it's caught.
And you've learned from Francis
Schaeffer? I learned from seeing him in action.
Okay.
I mean, you could watch him with people, and he had such compassion. I said he took people seriously. After 5 minutes, you could see his eyes welling up with tears as he got into their worlds. And always, the first step in apologetics is to can all the methods. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Can them all. Jesus never talked to two people the same way.
Mm.
Now, Jesus, of course, knew immediately what was in the heart because of who he was. We don't. So we've got to begin by listening and asking questions to listen even more and say things like, tell me your story. So the people really know we're interested in them and we're caring for them. And then we're beginning to hear the worldview that they're into. It's got to be personal. My apologetics is not bookish.
No.
You could say it's a human apologetics. It's an existential apologetics. I don't like the labels. But I got it all from Schaeffer and from my great hero in history, Pascal.
I see. So if sirens start sounding in people's heads, if they depend upon models or books, they should put those to one side.
Well, you read those too. Mm. They're helpful, but always in the light of people.
So Would you perhaps paint a picture, describe a scene, tell a story of your experience with Francis Schaeffer in Le Brie that would flesh out this in practice, caring about God and about people and about truth?
Now, to be honest, my mind's gone blank.
That's
on
fine.
One of an actual story.
We'll switch to Pascal then. What have you learnt from Pascal?
Pascal, to me, is the one who makes apologetics human.
Okay.
And in the middle of life. And he's the one who outlined this great idea of devotion. And if you've ever read the pages, the Pensée, I try and read once a year or so.
Okay.
And you read it several times, lots of it is irrelevant, because, of course, it was his jottings for a book that he never wrote, and he died at 39. But some of the most profound parts are his section on devotion. And he says it in all sorts of ways, and almost all of them are fascinating.
Now, so are you complimenting Pascal on his sharp eye in observing life and people and how he works? So the sociologist in Pascal is commendable?
Well, it's the spiritual psychology.
Okay.
In other words, if humans hold the truth in unrighteousness, they're always trying to squirm away.
Okay.
And Pascal has understood the spiritual psychology of unbelief, maybe better than anyone except perhaps Augustine.
So there's Pascal's spiritual psychology. A friend of mine who's done a master's on Pascal was interested to find in his manuscripts that at one stage, as he was presenting Christianity, he was holding up the alternatives and showing them that they don't stand up in the same way you have done with naturalism and with Eastern thinking.
Contrast is the mother of
contrast. But what's interesting is in his original manuscript, he started with not but two, but three oppositions. And he decided that for the clarity of his communication, he scratched one of them and stuck with two, so that, in a sense, when the truth was emerged, it would be seen clearly between the two oppositions. Are there any other communication approaches that you've learned from Pascal or from others, just to be clear in what you're saying?
Well, both from Schaeffer and from my own mentor, Peter Berger, I've learned to see that on most issues in the world, certainly in sociology, there's never just one problem. There are always two extremes.
Okay.
And the trouble with a lot of people is that they attack something, and then unwittingly they back into the arms of the opposite problem. So in any problem, this isn't just apologetics, anything, I like to anchor down the two extremes.
Mm.
Now, the trouble with this is people say, well, if you put two extremes, you make the gospel kind of like a high wire, and people are always afraid of falling off one side or the other. And that's not so, for a simple reason. The gospel has many, many truths which have a polarity. So God is sovereign, humans are significant. But that's only one of 100 truths you could put in there. Grace and law and so on. So if you put 100 truths with polarities together, what you've formed is not a high wire and you're afraid of falling off, it's a trampoline. Because the strength of a trampoline is all the different things that are tied, and in the middle, you have incredible resilience on which you can bounce. And for me, that's Christian truth. I'm never afraid of falling off one side or the other, although you're always aware of the two extremes, because there are so many truths that you have those poles in that together they make something that gives you a confidence in the resilience of the gospel.
Thank you. So, two final questions. The penultimate is, which of these truths are you most conscious of at the moment as needed in society or within the church? What are you working on at the moment?
Well, as a social scientist looking out in the world, I've got to say, everyone is now everywhere. Every faith and ideology the world's ever known is either physically present in the big cities or virtually available. I met someone who was into Roman mystery religion. He couldn't have found any other believers in that, but he gets it online. Everyone is now everywhere. We're in a world that Nietzsche described as a war of spirits. Kant predicted perpetual peace. He's wrong. We're in a world of a war of spirits. And Christians need to be flexible, seeing all the incredible range of beliefs, weird, wild, and wonderful sometimes. But principally, our main challenge today, I think, is taking on a strident secularism on one side, think of the new atheists, a militant Islam on the other side, and sadly our own weakness
mm.
and the failure of the church on the third side. And the apologist is working between those three poles in the main, although mm. of course there are umpteen views that people are into, and we just need to meet people where they are, share the gospel with them, and show the love of Christ to them.
Hmm. That ties very nicely with the final question. So if one of those three problems is the weakness of the church, what resources available would you point us towards? So thinking specifically for listeners of this podcast, where might they go to listen or to read and grow?
Well, you know the irony is today, the church is exploding in the global south, Asia, sub-Saharan Africa, and so on. Weak in the West, very weak in Europe, weakening in the United States. At the same time, if you make a generalization about the gospel in the West, I would say evangelism is much easier.
Hmm.
Discipleship is much harder. So we need to have apologists who are really grounded as disciples, hmm. who have a clear sense of calling. I wrote a book called The Call because I think that's one of the key issues in our world. But equally, growth in Christ and so on. So evangelism is relatively easy because the modern world shakes up people's identities, shakes up the institutions which give them a strong civility, and gives us 1,000 consumer preferences, so people are hopping and chopping, and the spiritual equivalent of channel surfing more than ever before.
Hmm.
And all the polls show that people are changing their views more than ever before. So put it all together, modern people are described as conversion prone, Peter Berger's words. In other words, evangelism's much easier than ever. But discipleship, giving them a vision of a lifetime sacrificial dedication to Christ despite everything, that's harder.
And that's worked out in the depth of relationships amongst Christians.
In relationships, but with a clear view of discipleship.
Just my closing observation, I've been very impressed by your humility, mainly talking less about yourself and more about Francis Schaeffer and others. And perhaps one application would be for us similarly to be both willing to be mentored by others and also to seek to mentor those younger than ourselves.
Well, none of us see very much. And, you know, as the early Christian said, we stand on the shoulders of giants.
Hmm.
And for me, three of the greatest giants are Augustine, way, way back, Pascal in the 17th century, and Francis Schaeffer and Peter Berger today. And I'm nothing without what I can see standing on their shoulders.
Thank you. Well, written 25 books and surprisingly taller than I expected. It's been great talking to you, Oz.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of UCCF's Christian Persuaders podcast. For more information, go to uccf.org.uk.